This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Before I tell you what I'm going to tell you, remember, it's just a snapshot, a quick picture of one part of the economy. Never mind that it's an especially important part, doing especially badly. We're talking housing here, folks, but you probably guessed that already, didn't you? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Siemens. From strengthened urban infrastructures to sustainable environmental solutions to advanced healthcare technology, Siemens' 70,000 U.S. employees are providing solutions for America. And by Bank of America, believing that healthy communities and a healthy planet are essential to creating opportunities for everyone. Bank of America, Bank of Opportunity.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Thursday today, the 11th of October. Great to have you here. I figure what we'll do is start in alphabetical order, just to be fair. Beazer Homes is first. The company announced today it's going to restate earnings back to 1999, something about problems, wait for it, with its mortgage unit. From there, we go on to Centex, Lennar, and Pulte. Moody's cut its debt rating for each of those home builders to junk today on the expectation the housing industry is going to be miserable until 2009. Also this morning, we got some new foreclosure numbers. Kind of a mixed bag there. Month to month, the news is actually pretty good. September 07 foreclosures were down from August. But year on year, that is since September 06, the number of people at risk of losing their homes has doubled. Now that you've digested all that, consider that it's entirely possible we'll look back not too long from now and see this as the easy part. Because over the next year or so, millions of adjustable-rate mortgages will recalibrate to higher interest rates. We asked Marketplace's Steve Tripoli to climb into our little time machine with the dial set for, say, next August and give us tomorrow's news today.
I caught up to Wellesley College housing expert Carl Case in the time machine. Here's what he says the chatter will be next August.
We were watching a train wreck slowly unfold.
Case says that even back in late 07, we knew those exploding adjustable-rate mortgages would bring more pain. Mark Zandi at MoodysEconomy.com was there next August, too. Here's what he says we'll have seen.
The worst run-up in mortgage loan defaults and foreclosures since the Great Depression.
Zandi saw it coming back in 07, too. He knew then that 1.4 million mortgage defaults were still ahead, and that the millions of households whose mortgage payments were going up would be shelling out an extra $350 per month on average. But then my time machine started acting up, just when I was asking about the larger impact of this mess. Zandi saw the culprits.
There's a couple of wild cards here.
The wild cards gummed up the machine and landed us with a bump back in the present. Zandi picked up one of the cards and saw this possible future.
We have some control through policy. If policymakers are prudent, we might be able to get through this with at least a little bit less damage.
Rick Sharga from RealtyTrack picked up the other wild card. It also showed a way to lessen the pain.
If the rest of the economic conditions stay in place, the market should be well positioned to stabilize pretty rapidly. The thing we have to avoid is market panic.
But will the economy stabilize without panic? And will policymakers step up to the plate? Sorry, for those answers, you'll need a better time machine than mine. I'm Steve Tripoli for Marketplace.
Big drug makers aren't waiting for the future to happen to them. Today, they started pulling cold and cough remedies aimed at children under the age of 2 off store shelves. Studies have found some of them can have serious side effects, including fatal ones, and that there's no proof they work in young children. Jeremy Hobson reports from Washington. The drug companies are trying to stay one step ahead of the Food and Drug Administration.
The FDA is meeting next week. If the agency doesn't ban the infant products altogether, it could decide to change Ask Your Doctor label warnings to something more severe. But Dr. Joshua Sharfstein, who is Baltimore's health commissioner, says it's long past time for action. He authored a petition in March calling on the FDA to do something.
These products had sort of snuck onto the market without a really serious review of their safety and effectiveness.
Sharfstein applauds the decision by some companies to pull the meds off the shelves. Well-known brands of infant cold and cough remedies like Robitussin, Dimetapp, and Tylenol. But he says it's not time for parents to rest easy yet.
This is a voluntary action by a certain set of manufacturers, so it could be that other manufacturers could come in and just sell it again unless the FDA takes a definitive action.
The trade group Consumer Healthcare Products Association maintains that the products are safe and effective when used as directed. Linda Sudam is the group's president.
Most parents use these medicines correctly, but it's important that all parents can use these products correctly.
For parents of small children like Erin Murphy of Houston, all this just adds to the confusion.
I think as a mother, it's really frustrating because you don't know if what you're giving them is actually helping them or harming them.
Today's voluntary recall does not affect medicines for kids older than 2, though there have been concerns on that front as well. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
There was economic news to spare today, even apart from all that hoopla about housing. Retail sales numbers for September were generally disappointing. Companies fell back on that old saw about the weather being a problem for them. September was apparently too hot, I guess. None of that matters in the end, though, when you've got Walmart, the world's biggest retailer, boosted its profit outlook for the coming quarter. That helped Wall Street to an early high. And the trade gap fell to the lowest it's been in 7 months. The ever-declining dollar helped American exporters sell more stuff overseas. Maybe they were selling online, maybe not, but the international language of the Internet is set to get a bit more international. At the moment, there's only one alphabet in which you can do that WWW thing. URLs are generally limited to Roman letters. Not much help to the billions of people who use different alphabets. From the Marketplace Innovations Desk at North Carolina Public Radio, Janet Babin reports the Internet's going truly global.
Beginning Monday, Internet users will be able to type 11 new languages in the part of the web address that comes after the dot. The Internet Association for Assigned Names and Numbers, or ICANN, is orchestrating the change. The U.S.-based nonprofit is under contract to the U.S. government. That's irked other countries that have complained for years that the Internet is too English-centric. Dr. Rafiq Dasani at Stanford says the added 11 alphabets are ICANN's idea of compromise.
There was a lot of controversy about ICANN being controlled within the United States, and they made some commitments that they would open up to global usage. And this is part of their commitment.
Among the lucky 11 new languages, Arabic, Chinese, Russian, Greek, Korean, Hindi, and Yiddish. Yiddish. Tina Dam is with ICANN.
And we looked at who had participated and expressed their opinions, and we picked those 11, and Yiddish was one of them.
ICANN will test the new languages for months to work out the technical kinks. But eventually, a whole new land rush will kick off. People will clamor to buy new Internet domain names from authorized companies. But the added languages are sure to bring up touchy trademark issues as people around the world try to register names that already have trademarks elsewhere. Michael Frumkins, a law professor at the University of Miami.
So historically, there have been lots of people who could use the name Delta in America, right? Delta Faucets, Delta Airlines. They both want to be Delta. Well, now magnify that by languages, magnify that by countries, and now magnify that by character sets.
Millions of dollars worth of business for international trademark lawyers. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
There were new highs all over the place on Wall Street today, and then they just disappeared. Maybe it was oil topping $83 a barrel. Maybe it was the tech sector leading the way down. That one gets my vote. Or maybe it was just a general case of ennui. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Ask yourself this as you start thinking about that home remodel you've wanted to do for ages now. Do you really need a 700-square-foot media room, a breakfast nook, and a spacious dining room, that enormous walk-in closet? If our mortgage payments are going up, it could be because our homes have gotten a lot bigger. Commentator Carrie Jacobs says Americans might have bitten off more than we can chew.
I think that the real estate bubble and its collapse have a backstory. Beyond low interest rates and creative lending practices, something happened in our collective psyche that transformed the humble American home into an object of feverish speculation. We abandoned the notion that modesty is a virtue. Now, when I bemoan the death of modesty, I'm not complaining about Britney Spears gyrating in her undies. No, I'm talking about the fact that we sold out the bedrock of the American dream, our precious homes, for yet another get-rich-quick scheme. Back in the post-war period, the home-building industry was born, and with it, the golden age of the American middle class. Most houses that were built back then were, in a word, modest. Levittown, where today's efficient methods of home-building and marketing were invented, consisted of houses that were a mere 800 square feet. The smartest post-war suburban developers were able to build architecturally adventurous homes for ordinary people. But today, ordinary people no longer want to perceive themselves as ordinary. I like to visit newly constructed subdivisions and wander through the million-dollar-plus model homes with names like the Whitney or the Getty. I'll bet you could fit an entire Levittown ranch house into the master bedroom of one of these babies. Sure, houses have always been status symbols. What changed is that we stopped buying our houses to cultivate an appearance of affluence. Instead, we began to buy houses as a shortcut to actual wealth. Buy a house named Getty, flip it, and you too can be a Getty. Well, you could have, up until a few months ago. Personally, I hope the credit crunch has an upside. Maybe it will cross-pollinate with the green movement to renew America's affection for the modest house. Or, as I like to put it, less is the new more.
Carrie Jacobs is the author of The Perfect $100,000 House. She lives in Brooklyn, where she has a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage. Send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says Contact. Coming up, when nightmare becomes reality for lobster divers.
I could only move my head and my eyes were looking around, but I couldn't speak and my tongue couldn't move.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials lost 63 points today, 0.4% to close at 14,015. The Nasdaq fell 1.4%, 39 points. Ended the day at a neatly symmetrical 2772. The S&P 500 dropped 0.6%, 9 points to 1553. ExxonMobil slipped 0.5% despite rising oil prices. ConocoPhillips slid more than 1%. Walmart rose more than 2.75% after the company upped its profit forecast, as we mentioned. Nordstrom unraveled 7.5% today. That after the retailer said its third quarter numbers won't match expectations. Apple was upgraded by Goldman Sachs, but the stock still rolled downhill nearly 2.75%. Markets overseas rose in London. The FTSE rose 1.33%. The CAC 40 in France hiked nearly 1%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 4.64%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at CargillCreates.com. And by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals at Vanguard.com. These days, it seems that everyone is talking about sustainability. Want to know how you fit in? A new online game from American Public Media can help you find out what the world might look like if everyone lived, or at least consumed, like you. Go to our website, marketplace.org, and click on Consumer Consequences.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on retail sales for September. The winner of the Nobel Peace Prize is announced in Oslo. And it's getting cozier here on planet Earth. Tomorrow is the day of 6 billion anniversary, an observation by the United Nations to mark the approximate time in 1999 that the Earth's population reached 6 billion. That's double what it was in 1960. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Mark Monday on your calendars, everybody. There's a media event you are not going to want to miss. Another way to get the business news of the day. Besides us, of course, Fox News is going to be launching a business channel. We've got Los Angeles Times media writer Tim Rutten here to help us understand what it's all about. And Tim, before we get started, there's a piece of tape I want to play for you.
The way you think of business is about to change. The most powerful name in news is now doing business. Fox Business, coming October 15th.
Well, Tim Rutten, you heard that little piece of sound from the Fox Business Network there. What is going on in the world of television business news?
Well, what's happening is you may have thought that the world needs another financial news network the way it needs another bull riding channel. But Rupert Murdoch is going to give you one. And it's not quite like any business news you've ever seen, because if your listeners go to the foxbusiness.com website and take a look at this thing for themselves, what they're going to see is an awful lot of extremely attractive young women.
Don't we already have a television business network that, frankly, is doing pretty well for itself, CNBC?
Right. And here's where this story gets interesting, Kai. I'll throw you a question.
All right, shoot.
What is the most watched financial news program on American television?
I don't know.
Wouldn't you think it'd be, say, The Closing Bell?
Yeah,
Closing Bell on CNBC?
Yeah, but I figured that was too easy, so I opted for none
of
the above.
Or Squawk Box, maybe, the morning show that introduces you, where you get to see the futures and how irrelevant they are to everything. You know what it is? It's the staid old nightly business report on PBS.
On public broadcasting.
On public broadcasting. Yes, it is. And remember, the most watched show on cable news today is Bill O'Reilly. And at any given moment in his broadcast, Bill O'Reilly's largest audience is right around 1 million viewers. This is a relatively small universe of viewers, but a highly lucrative one for advertisers.
The guy who gets the credit for this, or I guess if it doesn't work out so well, who will get the blame, is a guy named Roger Ailes. Remind us who that is.
Roger Ailes is the guy who created Fox News for Rupert Murdoch. Roger Ailes' singular genius was to realize that the relatively small audience that watches cable news was really interested in news as a kind of buttress for its opinions. Roger Ailes gave an extended interview to the Wall Street Journal earlier this week. I think we can already see the Murdoch presence in the journal. Mm. The deal there isn't closed.
But his business channel guy is in the pages of the paper.
Well, not only that, but Fox News has replaced CNN in the on the televisions in the lobby of the journal building, the Dow Jones building. But this interview, I took the trouble of going to read the entire transcript of the interview. And what's fascinating about this is Fox positioned itself as the conservative antipod to the purportedly liberal CNN. Ailes is trying to do exactly the same thing with this network. This network is going to be pro-business as opposed to CNBC, which he says is anti-business.
Yeah, but if you've ever watched CNBC, and I'm sure you have, and a lot of people listening probably have, it's not like they're anti-business. I mean, come on.
I mean, this is the network of Larry Kudlow, for God's sake. It's also anti-capitalist, according to Ailes, that the only time the CNBC people believe in capitalism is when they go to negotiate their contracts, he says. Look, with all respect to the people on CNBC, if they boosted the stock market anymore, they'd all be on retainer to the brokerage houses. I mean, so the question is, will this play? Can he create an ideological basis for people to choose Fox Business over CNBC?
Tim Rutten writes the Regarding Media column for the Los Angeles Times. Thank you, Tim.
My pleasure.
You can go to a local chain restaurant any day of the week and order a lobster tail for maybe $15.
We import almost 120 million pounds of lobster every year, a lot of it caught by hand down in the Caribbean, where right now the lobster season is in full swing. Our series, Working, takes us into the lives of individual people in a constantly changing global economy. Today, we go to Honduras, where 3,000 men make their living diving for lobster. Dozens of them are seriously hurt on the job every year. Some of them die. Claudine LaMonaco has the story, though, of one who's not quite ready to quit.
On land, Romulo Graham is a crippled man. His knees tremble when he walks, and he looks like he might crumple with every step. But in water, he says he is perfect, strong, and able to work. For the last 30 years, Graham has made his living diving, more than 100 feet deep, down to the floor of the Caribbean, stalking lobster. In places like Maine and Nova Scotia, lobsters are caught in traps. But where Romulo Graham lives, on the Mosquito Coast in Honduras, it's cheaper to use divers than it is to use traps. Cheaper, but a lot more dangerous. 20 years ago, Graham was diving at around 120 feet when things went wrong.
The day of my accident, I wanted to catch more lobster than anybody else. I used a lot of tanks that day, 16 tanks. In those days, we didn't have any training.
Any trained diver knows that using 16 oxygen tanks that deep in one day is crazy. The way these guys dive, that's more than 6 hours at depth. U.S. diving experts say that about an hour split between 3 to 4 dives would be safe. But Graham's story is common here, and you can see the consequences. Walk through Graham's village, or any village along the Mosquito Coast, and if you didn't know better, you'd think there'd been a war here. Beneath the towering mango trees and coconut palms, men move along the dirt paths on crutches or in wheelchairs. Family members pull quadriplegics on planks with wheels. All of them were injured diving. Graham's own problem started as a sharp pain in his ribs when he came up from his 16th dive. Within a half hour, he was completely paralyzed.
I could only move my head and my eyes were looking around, but I couldn't speak and my tongue couldn't move.
He couldn't breathe and passed out. He came to at a clinic not far from his village.
There was a doctor there, and he said, "Oh, my son, you can't walk anymore. You are paralyzed." And I began to think, I'm so young, and now I'm paralyzed? I have 3 girls to look over. My God, if I die, who's going to take care of these 3 little girls?
Graham needed a decompression chamber, but the nearest one was on the Cayman Islands, and the boat captain wasn't going to pay for that. Graham spent months in bed. Several times a day, his wife would exercise his fingers, toes, and legs. After 9 months, he got out of bed with crutches. Finally, he threw away the crutches.
I'd fall on the ground all the time, but I wasn't ashamed. I'd get up and walk again. People would say, "You're falling in the streets. Why don't you stay at home?" And I would tell them, "No. Sure, I fall, but it's not a problem."
Graham tried farming for a couple of years, but his kids would often go hungry. His wife begged him not to go back to sea. "If you die," she said, "then what good will you be?"
I said, "Look, wife, there is no other way I can support you and our family. I have to go out and dive." And I went out. My wife was crying, but I went and it was okay.
Graham still dives, but he's trying to save others from the injuries that he suffered. Today, he's out on a small boat teaching a handful of Mosquito Indians the basics of diver safety. Graham's one of about a dozen lobster divers certified this spring as teachers by the Honduran Navy. It's the first systematic attempt to train the country's divers. Diving's the only industry on the Mosquito Coast. Aggressive divers can earn up to $6,000 in a 6-month season. Graham has the men review their charts to see how long they can dive and check their equipment to make sure it works. Scuba gear here is outdated and often malfunctions. Divers have no depth gauges and no way of knowing how much air they have left. During lobster season, these guys will go out for 2 weeks at a time on boats crammed with as many as 100 men. The lobster stocks are so depleted here that every year the divers have to go deeper. Graham tells his students they need to slow down.
You can't use more than 8 tanks a day because you'll get too much nitrogen in your system.
One by one, the men put on their fins and masks and jump into the water. They'll go down 90 feet, then practice coming up slowly and safely. Graham is trying to limit the time these men scramble for lobster on the seafloor. Typically, divers stay on the bottom until they run out of air, then push off and shoot up to the surface. That's when they get what's known as the bends. It's like when you open a Coke can and bubbles rush to the top. Only with humans, it's nitrogen bubbles that burst into muscles and the bloodstream, causing joint pain, paralysis, or death. When divers have a nitrogen attack, a decompression chamber can help. Graham takes me to a nearby clinic with 3 chambers that were installed in the 90s. Trouble is, the chambers don't work. Inside, walls are crumbling. Bats squeak in the rafters, and everything, including the large tubular chambers, is covered in guano. We have to step over a dead bat to get to the largest chamber. Aurelia Ponce, who heads the clinic, says there hasn't been any money or trained doctors to run the chambers for the last 4 years.
Every year when the season starts, many divers come here, poor guys, and they die because there's no chamber. If we could get them in the chambers, then they would recover.
Before we leave, the doctor tells Graham he shouldn't be diving. He's still got too much nitrogen in his system. He's risking his life every time he goes under. It's the same with all injured divers. Of the men on Graham's training boat, half have been seriously injured from nitrogen sickness. One nearly died from a brain embolism. Another, like Graham, walks with a permanent limp. But as soon as they finish the training, Graham and his fellow divers will all head to the seafloor to catch as many lobsters as they can.
Claudine LaMonaco reported that story for us in collaboration with Homelands Productions. For earlier installments and pictures about our series, Working, head to our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Consumer Consequences, American Public Media's online game, exploring what the world would be like if everyone on Earth consumed like you. Online at consumerconsequences.org. And by Putnam Investments, where a well-thought-out allocation strategy can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, also, as it happens, from the Marketplace Time Machine.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, here's Johnny.
Johnny Carson left beautiful downtown Burbank in 1992 when he retired and passed The Tonight Show to Jay Leno. Come 2011, NBC is going to be leaving Burbank entirely. The General Electric subsidiary said today it's putting most of its 34-acre Burbank property on the auction block right away. It's going to rent backspace for Leno and The Tonight Show until its new green facility in Universal City is ready. Beautiful downtown Universal City? Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow stumbled 63 points, 0.4%. The Nasdaq tumbled 39 points. That's 1.4%. The S&P 500 drooped 0.6% there. Our editors include Kevin Arnovitz, Patty Hirsch, Margaret Koval, Karen Lowe, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker. Coming up next time, Silicon Valley types go looking for bargains.
That's kind of a sign that you've arrived, is when things you designed start showing up the flea market.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.